Hello, friends and listeners. I'd like to thank our sponsors, the Avery Hotel and Brasserie. Located in the heart of downtown is Boise's only historic boutique hotel, meticulously renovated by renowned chef Cal Elliott. The property boasts two unique restaurants, both anchored by 100-plus-year-old Brunswick bars. The Avery Brasserie, with a diverse French-inspired menu, and Tyner's Alley, with a dark and moody English pub vibe with scotch eggs and free pool. I've eaten at both, and let me tell you, they scrumptious. With beautiful soaking tub and balcony rooms and suites overlooking the historic gem block on 10th and Main Streets, you can find modern, elevated comfort and rich history perfect for visiting guests, staycations, and special occasions. And let me tell you, I've gotten my relaxation on in these rooms. Oh, soaking tubs, soaking my feet, eating some treats and drinking some cocktails. And it's historic, baby. Lots of crazy stuff happened in this hotel since its construction back in 1910. Find out more about the Avery at theaveryboise.com. People often say, history's boring. And I say, slow down. Pull your head out. Think a bit. History is a fundamental building block of civilization. And it's the way we describe our civilizations and the human condition within it. It can be so many different things, just as humans are so many different things. And so it can be fun, and it can be depressing. It can be funny, and it can be boring and dry. It can be many things, and often, whether you enjoy history or not, is dependent on those telling the stories, the historians, those presenters of the past. And we think we can take you down the right road. Straight out of Boise, Idaho, we are the Highway to History Podcast. Join us. Thank you to the Trendy Dads out of San Francisco, California, for that wonderful cover of the B-52's Private Idaho.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Highway to History podcast. I'm here, Mark Iverson, and my pal,
London Talbot.
London Talbot. He's a 40 winer. I got another 40 winer here.
40 winer.
Yeah,
I'm 40 winer.
But he's a good guy. His name's Phillips. Hayman. Hyman's.
Yeah. They're not good. Philip Hayman.
Hyman, that one that did get spun to that, you know, back in middle school.
Oh, sure.
High school. It's Hyman. No.
It's Hayman.
Just like it's spelled. And it's. How do you pronounce your name?
Exactly like I'm spelled.
Hey, okay. Hey, I can't spell.
Man.
But you are currently a mechanic. You do some on the side mechanic, but that's how I met you. You came and saved my ass. Now, this is probably your third or fourth time something happened on this GMC that we're talking on, right?
Yes. Old loader.
Yep. And so what do? Just here in Boise, you live in Nampa. And
yeah, I live in Caldwell. But yeah, I just do I'm just mobile mechanic. When people's cars don't start or need work done, I come to them rather than them having to wait in a, you know, the 2-week wait or whatever it is to get your car into a shop these days.
Well, you've been a logger, you've been a fisherman, you've been a crabber, but for the first time in my life, I think I have in my life a honest mechanic. I have to convince you to take more money. But the reason I wanted to have you on the show, and London was like, oh, this sounds cool, is to talk about, well, fishing in Alaska. Alaska has an amazing history. You and I have been bullshitting on that for a while. I dabbled in like a month and a half of fishing in what you call these prison
ships,
Fisherman's Finest Inc. And it was the most god-awful fucking physical experience I ever had, but the best education. We were way the fuck up somewhere high up north in the Bering Sea, is it?
Yeah.
And we were going for these things called Yellow Soul.
So you're out west.
Oh, that was fucking hard, man. And you guys, you don't have like guys who are like, okay, good work, guys. You're like, get the fucking move. And you're like, you're pulling big 45-pound blocks of frozen fish. I was just like,
that's brutal.
I was just like, I'm being hazed so hard here, I'm gonna puke because I can't stop.
Yeah.
And you're just broken. And then that's why they liked me in the end. I just shut up and did my thing. But I didn't even realize that I came home from a month and a half. I had a 6-pack. I was fucking cut. And then I started drinking Seattle beer again.
Yeah.
This is 2010, and that shit went away real quick. But yeah. I was sorting fish in my sleep. You know, when you first get on this boat, I'm back to two in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
I'm drinking energy drinks, especially Rockstar. I'm fucking puking on the side of the ship and going right back to you know,
yeah,
being yelled at for about a week until they got like, oh, okay, this guy is working real hard and listening to what we say. And so then the hazing kind of got a little less and it got a little better. But when they asked me to go, I guess, south of the Aleutians to do some like pollock.
Oh, yeah.
Fishing or some cod, pollock.
You were trawling, right?
Yeah. But they basically were like, you want a bag? I'm like, fuck no, man.
Go do B season for pollock?
Oh, God, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do any of it. So it was a hell of an education. But when you started talking to me about crabbing and your fishing experience, and especially ghost towns up in Alaska, I just said, I got to have this guy on because you know some shit about deadliest catch or reality versus what, you know, is shown on TV.
Yes.
And, you know, you're talking about the Wild West days. They call them the Derby days crabbing.
Yeah.
And just anyway, how do you get into fishing?
So how I got into it is my mom and stepdad, he fished. He was a commercial fisherman. He did salmon in Bristol Bay, which is basically the top of the Bering Sea.
Okay.
The headwaters of the Bering Sea is Bristol Bay. I mean, that's where one of the biggest river systems, the Kwajalein, and it produces, I don't remember the exact statistic on it, but it produces a very large percentage of the world's sockeye salmon.
Okay.
So that's how I got into it. I was a little kid, my stepdad did it, and I got I was 9 years old because I turned 10 at the end of that summer. I just went up and got to go work with the guys.
Now, you showed me some stuff, Battle on the Bay.
Battle on the Bay, yeah, that was a...
Oh, my gosh.
They tried to do Deadliest Catch style.
Right.
And it was just the Bristol Bay salmon run. But the boats are a lot smaller than your crabbers, but it's just wild. And it used to be a lot more wild. Those people, believe it or not, have calmed down substantially.
Oh, it looks like Mad Max, the movie, but with boats. It's like they're just fucking each other up. And
they got buoys all the way around them.
Right.
I've seen guys nose to nose, black smoke just rolling out of the exhaust stacks, just going roll.
Pushing each other.
So this was a reality TV show?
Yeah. Oh, it was called Battle on the Bay. And it was, so like one of my last years fishing up there was when they filmed it. And it just didn't take off. It was like just one of those 8-episode or 10-episode miniseries things. Mm-hmm. I knew every one of the boats that was on it. What the heck is the fast boat that's on there that they, so his dad owned the Vulcan and he was one of my dad's, you know, fishing associates and friends. And it was just, it was crazy.
Would friends go at each other in
this? Oh, yeah. There was no...
And so what you're doing is trying to get positioned to cast your net.
So you've got with one permit, you've got 3 shackles of gear, and a shackle is 50 fathoms.
Okay.
So on one permit, you're allowed 150 fathoms of net. And
what's a fathom? How long?
6 feet.
Okay. Jules Verne. Yar.
Sea Tom. What it's kind of, unless you've done it, it's really hard to, describe what's going on. But so
that water is moving fast. Alaska has the like highest current, you know, tides.
Yeah. In the
world. And so there's like up to 30 feet of tide in July. So every 6 hours, the water level is going up and down 30 feet. And you've got these narrow, shallow bays. Like most of the time, you're not in more than 10 or 20 feet of water.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's all a mud flat out there.
Okay.
And that tide will get moving. At the mouth of the river, the tide will get moving 5 or 6 knots, which is, you know, I think a knot's 1.2 or something like that, miles per hour. So when you go out there and you've got so you fish the south line on the flood and the northern end of the district on the ebb or on the outgoing.
Right, okay.
When you go, so the reason that your position is those fish are kind of running up the beach. They school and they channel up the beach.
Right.
So, and you've got, what is that? Roughly an eighth of a mile, a little over an eighth of a mile of net that you're trying to lay in front of these fish. And when the tide's running like this and you got the GPS line, you've got cops literally sitting there in their little skiffs. Sometimes it kind of, they got to where they weren't, cops used to be tough, but now they just kind of like to sit on the boat and like fly over the line every once in a while and just hand out tickets to everybody on the left side of the picture or whatever.
So they're doing that to make sure that you're staying in.
You have to stay in your district, and it is a very closely monitored district. So you go out there and you throw your ball on the line. By the time, those boats aren't fast. I mean, they're 10, 12 knots when you're setting. By the time you get to the end of the net, you're already 0.2 mile inside of the line.
And
you've got 10 nets in front of you. So your open shot, like realistically, your open shot is very, very short window. And you're getting, like during the peak when the fish are really running, I mean, we'd have 15,000 pounds and only 30 seconds of exposure.
Shit. And so you guys are jockeying for position.
That's why it's so important to get that pole position or whatever. And it was kind of funny because the tenders, the tenders where you deliver your fish to, those tenders would anchor just outside the south line so that in peak season, if your boat got full, you could run to the tender. Or when they're starting to run 8-on-4 off, your tender's really close. You go dump your fish and get back to, you know, you go sleep for an hour or whatever and then go back fishing.
Okay, so sleep. You just said sleep.
Yeah,
that's a rarity.
It's a precious resource.
That's a rarity in what we've been talking about. I remember, you know, on the factory boat thing, like, you know, we'd get like 4 hours, 5 hours sleep, and I wasn't sleeping. I was sorting fish in my, you know. I was like, God, I want to sleep. I can't sleep. But one thing you and I were talking about is a lack of sleep. So this fish, it sounds like it's intense, but as far as grueling endurance, it doesn't sound like when you describe crabbing.
So crabbing is grueling endurance for sure, because the boat is always moving. There's not so with salmon, the Alaska Fish and Game Department, it's a really closely monitored fishery. So they have, and to this day, I don't know how they work. Supposedly, they got like some sonar counting towers that can estimate the amount of fish that have made it past into the headwaters where they actually will breed.
Okay.
Or lay their eggs or whatever. So they've got them. So they'll say, well, we have 200,000 past the tower and 100,000 in the lagoon, and we want a total of 1.8 million fish escapement, right? So based on those numbers, they'll say, okay, well, we're going to be open for 8 hours this day during this stages of tide, and then we're going to close it down.
Okay.
And give the fish a chance to, you know, make it up the river.
Right.
And then we're going to open it again. And they'd always give you like half of the ebb and half the flood. So it was always like an 6 to 8 hour opening. And then once they got their escapement, they just blow the doors up and then say, just catch them all.
Okay.
Oh. But it's a terminal fishery. So those fish go up there, when they spawn, they die.
Oh, yeah, right.
So at the end of the season, it would suck because you just get these nets full of ghost fish, we'd call them. And they're just these rotting sacks of just flesh, you know.
Yeah.
It's just so nasty. But all the fish are just washed out of the river.
You know what I'm wondering? I'm wondering if up there on that tributary, if there's anybody hiking around, if it's like the worst fucking season to be there because you got bears up the ass.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what is his name? Grizzly Man? Like, you fucking go hug him.
Yeah.
It worked out a lot, but it just takes one grizzly to change his mind. But okay, so that's, you did that fishing, and then did you graduate to, you were calling it seine lining or
seining?
Seining.
Seining. I liked seining. Seining is more of a it equates to more with the exception of the what the heck do they call that? The Togiak Roundup, where it's this big battle to get herring. Seining is more of a gentleman's fishing. You're not out there trying to, like, you're not just laying your net right in front of somebody else.
You dual boat to boat. You're like, sir,
yeah,
you cut off my boat, sir.
Everybody gets a 20, like, if you're fishing a point, everybody gets 20 minutes at open time, and then your net closes up, and then the next net comes in, he gets 20 minutes, and they'll start these lines with these, like, radio that they'll call it the mayor of the point, you know?
Oh, really?
And he'll be in charge of, okay, well, it's your turn, and then it's your turn, and it's just a completely different, as opposed to Bristol Bay, where it's like they're screaming and cussing and throwing suit cans. And stuff.
Man, you see fights in Bristol Bay?
Oh, man. Like, Bristol Bay is rough.
Like, they get out, they like, you know, dock, and then they get out and just start fucking each other up.
Oh, I've had, well, there's no docking because everybody's, you know, kept on anchor, you know, you always anchor up. But I've seen people jump off. I've actually seen a couple of people that we knew that fished in our little group with us. One guy jumped off onto, Elliot Ness, remember, I told you about Elliot. It's a little,
oh, yeah, the
guy, captain. That captain off the Deadliest Catch, the little junkie or whatever. But he had an aluminum shore boat, and he tried to fish Bristol Bay for a little bit, and he got into it with my friend, Steve Currian. And they went, like, nose to nose, and I think Steve jumped off onto Elliot's boat, and they were, like, in a fist fight. And then Steve turned around and realized that his boat had drifted. So it's like, what do you do, you know?
Oh, wow.
But yeah, that stuff used to happen all the time. You get some really hot-headed people. But if you think about how much money they stand to make or lose in this really short period of time, it just tempers flare big time.
Mm.
So,
that's why. So, like, on the factory ship, those guys, like the foreman and some of the old hands, they're just sitting there, like, whenever you want to bitch and moan about working, they're like, look at that one fish is a dollar, like, yeah. $1. You're like, just the more you do, like, just if you think it's money, just look at it like it's money flying in, and that'll change you. And so, like, you know, they said, when we yell at you, it's because we want you to work hard because that's money and it's your money too.
Yeah.
And so the guys that would just sit on their ass and, like, would invoke the fury of all the guys that were their livelihood was on the line, right? And it just seems like an intense world, period.
Well, and it's almost, so with Reds especially, it was like, depending on, you know, what the market was doing and stuff, we'd get anywhere from $1.25 to $1.75 a pound. And those fish, the average weight on those fish was 6 to 8 pounds.
Oh, shit.
So, I mean, it was a lot of money really fast. Bristol Bay, I think, still to date is, like, the most money you can make in the shortest amount of time, especially as, like, a boat owner. You're looking at, you know, like, the good guys, which my stepdad was always, he was, like, number one boat in the bay a couple of years, but he was never outside of the top 10%. And so you're talking, you know, between 200,000 and 300,000 pounds of fish.
Jeez.
And they call it a 6-week season, but you got a week worth of boat work at the beginning and about 3 or 4 days worth of boat work at the end. And then you've got all this piddling around while the fish aren't showing up yet. And there's a lot of, you know, time sitting on the hook but for the most part, your actual, like, grueling work schedule is 2.5 to 3 weeks. And you have a 10% deckhand is making, you know, 20 to 40 grand in basically 2 to 3 weeks of actual work.
Damn.
I mean, that's a year's worth of salary.
That's insane.
Anywhere else, right? So, I mean, I know a lot of those guys up there that would, that's all they did. My stepdad's brother was a classic example. The rest of the year, he had a house in Costa Rica, and he had bunch of like junk car collection in Lewiston, Idaho, and who fished for 6 weeks and who drank the rest of the year. He's one of those guys that if you don't call him before 11, he's not leaving his house because he doesn't want to give you more DUIs.
So that is, the money's real with that, even though the people up there are crazy people.
Well, that's why it's so crazy, is because that's their entire year's livelihood. Yeah, most of those guys. My stepdad did the helicopter logging the rest of the year. So,
God, he's a hard worker.
He is insanely hard worker. I hate him, but still respect his work ethic to this very day, even though we haven't talked in, years.
Wow.
But, yeah, he definitely taught us kids how to work.
Okay, so then you go from this gentleman's, fishing,
seining's the gentleman's fishing, yeah.
And so you just do a little loop-de-loop with a net around the fish and then
close it up, right. And then there's a purse seining. So you've got on the bottom of your net, you've got all these rings that you suck a line through, and it puckers the bottom of the net. So now the top of the net's floating on corks, and then our web was 90 feet. So basically anything in that ring is now yours for the taking.
Well, so why did you get into crabbing? Is that something you did while you were doing this?
So crabbing, most of the crabbing I did was coastal crabbing. And we fished from San Francisco California and Oregon permit. And then we also had Alaska dungies. We did way out the chain out in Sandpoint, and then we did
we didn't do any
southeast. So it was all mainly just way out the chain for dungies.
But you were talking about Dutch Harbor, like you were coming out of Dutch Harbor too sometimes.
Yeah. That's Kings. Yeah. And that was a lot of the Dutch Harbor stuff was I knew all those guys really well. Bryce, and Sear was the same. He had the Amatuli, but he was one of the guys that would actually ferry the Deadliest Catch camera crew out to the Deadliest Catch boats.
And you were saying you knew, like, in Seattle, we know that there's the bar in Ballard near Hiram's Lock.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's got great breakfasts, great drinks, cocktails. It's a great place. It's one of those places that's legit. But that's where some of the Deadliest Catch guys would go when they were in Seattle.
Yeah.
It's Sig Hansen or whatever his name is. I watched a few seasons of that and I was like, whatever.
And it is. It's like, it's kind of goat roping at a certain.
Well, you're kind of thing
over and over again.
It is. It just, and then you're like, I'm wondering what is bullshit versus what's real. And you were telling me basically like those dudes are not the top.
No, they're not.
Fishermen or crabbers because they're catching other crabbers' quota part of it.
A lot of it is lease quota. So one of my stepdad's best friends, Jorn was his name, but I think he's like got one of the highest crab catch records in the world, over the course of his lifetime.
Thanks.
And when the show approaches people like him, he doesn't have time because he's got crab to go catch. So the bottom of the fleet, and it was the same with that show that I had you watch about Bristol Bay, that Battle on the Bay. It was the same. Those weren't your highliners. The one guy was the son of a highliner.
Okay.
But these were not your highline people. The highliners didn't have time for the show. I mean, and then a lot of the quota on Deadliest Catch was leased quota. A lot of guys that had gotten too old or sold out or just didn't want to fish their quota anymore would then lease their quota to these other boats. And that's what the Deadliest Catch guys ended up with was more just, the leftovers, basically.
So they catch this other chunk of quota.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so some of the profits go back to the leaser?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so if you're going to fish somebody's quota, you're going to charge them. But for the most part, so like if I'm going to lease you my quota, I would say, well, I want 10% or, because I don't have a boat anymore. So they're still going to have to pay to fish that quota. It's still good money because you got all the expense of your boat and your crew and, all that stuff. But yeah, you have to lease quota and you're an idiot to sell quota because it's like perpetual income because somebody's always going to want to fish it.
Right.
You don't have to work for it anymore. And the money in king crab and like halibut quota is pretty damn good. It's like not even worth trying to buy.
Well, halibut's really expensive, right?
Yeah, it's like $25 a pound or something.
And king crab is really expensive too.
Dude, there's a place in maybe you've heard of it, but I worked there. It's called Spud's Fish and Chips in Seattle. And they used to have free, but it's a staple. And now to get our halibut and chips, holy shit, man. It's like, maybe I might as well go to a fucking fancy restaurant and get that shit. It's delicious.
Crazy to think, though, like the stuff you're talking about, you don't think when you're going to the grocery store or you're going to a seafood restaurant or whatever, the process and the hard work and the insanity that goes into just getting that fish there for people to eat. You know, you just think it's there. You don't even think about it.
I'd like to thank our sponsors, Funky Soul Coffee. That's soul with an S-O-L. It's the brainchild of Michelle Russell and Gavin Butler. These two had a dream, and that was to turn a 1976 Airstream camper into a coffee shop, a 70s-themed coffee shop. And they've succeeded. Michelle Russell has years and years of experience in the coffee industry, and she's come up with some truly delicious 70s-themed concoctions. I've had the privilege of tasting a few of them. You can reach them at 208-447-9044. You can email them at hello@funkysoul.com. And you can find them on Instagram or at www.funkysoulcoffee.com. Give them a try.
Well, so this, and shelf space is where all the money's at.
Yeah.
Because like I said, like, so when we were, we kind of were a group of boats in Bristol Bay that piloted this. So Leader Creek Fisheries came in, the guy's John Lorenz. He had this idea that, hey, we're going to start this quality market. Because for the most part, for years, a lot of that Bristol Bay salmon went to canning.
Mm.
And so, because that's how they were able to preserve it, right? Well, with the progression of technology, they started doing this boneless vacuum packed fillet, and they only wanted number ones for it because you didn't want bruising, and they would take it to, you know, Pike's Place Market or Albertsons.
Right. Yeah.
And that's where it started to gain a lot of popularity, and that's when it actually broke up from the big three, because you had Trident, Snowpack, and
Trident, yeah,
Ocean Beauty were the big ones, and they basically dictated the price. So when I first started fishing back when I was 9, they called it the Salmon Depression.
Oh, wow.
And
did a monopoly a little
bit. They had this huge monopoly because they pushed all the cash buyers, the Japanese buyers would come in, and they had these big floating processors, kind of like the one we were storing on.
Right.
And they would buy salmon, and there was a free market. Basically, you could take your fish to whoever. Well, when they passed the law that pushed all the processors way offshore, they could no longer buy from the fishermen directly. They had to buy from Trident, or they had to buy from Ocean Beauty, and they had to be 40 miles offshore to do it.
Freedom and capitalism.
Yeah. So it was a really bad deal for the fishermen. It was a great deal for the big companies. Okay. And like, so, I mean, I remember as a little kid, my stepdad was a big enough deal in Bristol Bay that we got to go meet Chuck Bundrant, the owner and founder of Trident Seafood.
Holy
and
shit.
He was like vying for Bryce, you got to come fish for me, because he was, you know, he was like number one in the bay. And it was, so I got to meet, I remember I was really little. And like, now I look back, I'm like, oh man, that was
Chuck Bundrant,
you know, like that was the
Trident
Seafood.
Yeah. Dude, one of the reasons I wanted to try fishing is because in Spuds, like I saw these badass pictures they had all over Spuds of Trident fishermen.
Yeah,
that's why.
And that was it was just, it's a, I mean, I didn't know it at the time. I mean, I couldn't, it was just another guy, you know, but now I look back on it, it's like, I met Chuck Bundrant, you know.
I've never heard of him, but
yeah, you know, I mean, in the seafood world, that was a big,
thing.
And then when he bought Tyson Seafoods,
Tyson Chicken,
he bought the seafood.
Oh,
so Trident is actually owned by, Trident actually owned Tyson.
Wow.
Seafood. They kept the chicken.
For sure.
And kept their chicken.
For sure.
But yeah, there was a Tyson Seafood. Trident bought them up.
And did they keep the name Tyson Seafood, or did they change it?
I don't remember what they did, and it's been a long time. It's been a few years.
That's okay.
But, But yeah, it was just like I'd met all these, you know, big names in the fishing, because I didn't realize how elite, I guess, or how many or how few people actually did fishing.
But right, they get the monopoly and then they fuck over the fishermen.
Oh, hugely.
It's just like any industry where they do like
it's
farming.
$36 a pound for a vacuum. And granted,
Monsanto, yeah. Right.
Granted, there's some loss in fishing. So, you know, like when you deliver fish, the head, the guts, that always, you know, we're dealing in, we're dropping these fish off in the round, right? So, and we were on that, like I was saying with Lear Creek, we were picking these fish into, we had these stupid tarp setups on the deck. So like we're picking them out of the net. They're like bouncing onto this tarp. They're not getting bruised on the deck. And then they are going into RSW or refrigerated seawater. So we would hand bleed them and then they would die in this 28 degree water. So they die frozen.
Wow.
So it was a quality push. And then we started to see the price go up again. So we went from like 50 or 60 cents to, you know, $1.25. And then now that is, you know, continued up, but they started, doing the vacuum pack foot.
Mm.
There was another guy that's in Idaho in this little Oakley. Have you ever been to Oakley, Idaho?
Yeah, I've heard of him.
I have.
And there's some rich history over in Oakley, right?
Yep.
I
have some ancestors buried in Oakley, Idaho, actually.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's where I know it. He's Mormon.
Yep. I have Mormon ancestors. Yeah. And actually, it's even some of the Talbots, but there's also even like some Durfees and McBrides.
Durfee?
Or people who are like relatives. Yeah.
The Durfees?
On my grandma's side.
I love that name. Hey, we're going to Durfee's place.
Durfee is such a great name.
Durfee is. Yeah, that's a good one.
Myra.
But yeah, this guy, he invented the salmon pin bone machine.
Okay.
And he bought the old gym in Oakley.
What is
Oakley, Idaho? So it's the craziest thing, right? If you look at it, so he bought the old gym, the old high school gym, because Oakley is, you know, shut down.
Okay.
It takes up a whole basketball court, and it's like this track with all these like chutes and ladders and knives and little rams and shit. But in one end, there's a hopper that you dump in fish. And at the other end comes out this beautifully vacuum-packed, boneless fish fillet.
That's fucking amazing.
Dude, the guy's forgotten more than I'll ever know.
That's amazing.
He's an insanely, just brilliant guy.
Wow.
A like, self-proclaimed inventor. He's done all these, like, really cool things. Kodiak Marine is actually based out of Oakley, Idaho.
No, I didn't have shit on it.
Right.
Wow.
So, but yeah, when they put these production pin bone machines online... Trident was paying, you know, a couple million bucks to set them up, and that's how we got the quality back in the industry. The whole salmon pin bone thing. Now everybody has them, but for a while there, they were only the big three could afford them.
And it was really mainly in Oakley. You're saying was like the first one the guy made.
Yep, that's where he made it. Was the first one.
Wow.
And his original design didn't take off. Somebody else came up with a better design. I don't know to this day. And I've been to his shop because we actually built one of our Satan's gifts there. He helped us. You know, the facility and the welder and all that stuff that we built an aluminum skiff. But I don't know how it works. But somebody else came up with one, and his used like these little tiny, I don't know, microblade knives that would, but it would make little slits where the rib bones came out.
God.
And so it wasn't as aesthetically pleasing as this other one that somebody came up with, where it just basically took the spine and ripped it all out the top. So there wasn't any slits in the meat. I don't know how it worked.
If you politicians,
sorry to all the vegans.
Yeah, sorry. By the way,
but it would basically, but to this day, it's like, well, you put in a whole fish, and out the other end comes this vacuum packed little fillet, and it was at a fairly fast rate. I mean, it was like 30 fish a minute or something. It was like insane. It was way faster than, you know, the little Eskimos with their ulus in the Trident plant could hand fillet them.
Oh, so then
because that's originally
all these people out of a job.
Yeah, that's originally who was. Well, I mean, it wasn't all Eskimos, but it was you know, college students and people that wanted to go up and work at these canneries. They had a hand fillet line, and that was originally how they did their quality for it. And then they came with the salmon pin bone machine and put all those people out of a job. But they went and
did other things. So,
jeez.
So, okay, so I'm trying to string this here together, huh?
Well, I do want to know, I don't know if you're getting here, I want to know a little bit about how the drug trafficking.
So there's a lot of drugs
involved in fishermen and
fishing in general.
Well, so you told me that you got it like back in the old days, the Derby days.
So the Derby days. The Derby days, cocaine was like, part of fishing.
Okay.
I mean, I think it was like an ad. And so like, you know, when you're doing your expenditure breakdown, you had X amount for food, fuel, cocaine.
Yep.
And then, you know, as the crew member, you got, well, I need a percentage of that break of cocaine because I'm going to need to do it to make you this money.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And it was kind of a joke. So the autopilot, If you ever go up into the wheelhouse of a big crab boat,
right?
They've got this compass that's hooked to the autopilot for navigation purposes, and it's on a gyro on the dash. So no matter what the boat's doing, it's always flat, right?
Right.
Every one of those crabbers, if you walk up there and look at that autopilot, it's like completely just marked out. Like, how did you scratch your compass?
Oh,
and just completely scratched out. But that was like that with everything. And because Alaska is so remote, and there is a lot of more of your blue collar, you know, people up there that have a higher propensity to addiction or whatever you want to call it, drugs are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Like
supply and demand.
Supply and demand. Okay,
sure.
And I mean, not just a little bit more expensive, a lot more expensive.
Damn.
It was kind of a sad deal, but I mean, like I've seen firsthand and, you know, from both sides of the fence there, but you would get these people with them come in, especially natives. I mean, we all, you know, natives have a higher propensity to alcoholism.
Mm.
They would come in with these big fishing checks or their big oil money per caps and stuff. So like August, they'd be just buying new snowmobiles, new cars, new everything, and then a bunch of drugs, right? Well, their drugs had run out by about November or December, and so would their money. So they would start then selling their new snowmobiles and new cars or trading them for drugs. I saw it a lot. It's like, so I mean, personally, I had my struggles with drugs.
Mm.
And I tried to, when I got divorced 10 years ago or whatever, I tried to move to Alaska to get away from it because my biological dad has always lived up there.
It would make sense. Hey, the wilderness.
I thought, hey, the wilderness, I'm going to go up there. I'm going to get away from the drugs. Right. Because at that time I was crabbing on the coast. So and there's a huge amount of drug usage in the not necessarily the captains on the smaller boats, but the crew. It's kind of, we call it the bottom of the barrel. You know, you get a lot of dock rats.
But the captains don't really participate.
The captains and owners on the stuff, I mean, they have their money for a reason.
Okay.
You know, but you can't find anybody to work anymore. So you're kind of forced to dredge the bottom of the barrel. So
sure,
whoever just hard up for money, they're going to go out. And most of those guys have, you know,
issues with that.
Or whatever their vice is.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I've had two people that I've personally known that I gave them a big fishing check when I was running boats or you know, working under my stepdad as the second in command there, that we'd call it die of a fishing money overdose. Cause they would get these big checks and you'd call them a week later for the next trip and they're dead.
You know? It's like the old West coming to town, cowpoke money and fucking shit up the town.
Like we stopped in Ketchikan. We got paper checks in Valdez, and we stopped in Ketchikan for fuel. And these two deckhands of mine disappeared, and they come back and they needed money cause they really needed to get, you know, booze or something. And, they come back with like these envelopes, like $23,000 in them.
Jeez.
So that they can hit Seattle running, you know?
Oh my goodness.
It's $23,000 back then too.
Right.
Even more.
Yeah. This is like 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just
awesome. So is that when you were doing your core crabbing?
That's when I was doing my coastal crabbing and then the seining.
Okay.
But yeah, like I said,
So who's selling this? Like, who's trafficking this in, I guess? Is the
fishermen?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And where do they get it from? Seattle.
But the cocaine.
Seattle. I don't know where that. Where
does this all probably come from? The cartel at some.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure
it just works its way down the line. And I guess
it's not grown locally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, we're not supporting the local industry.
Sure. I get you. I get you.
So I don't know who and where it comes from.
Yeah,
but it ends up in port towns.
Okay,
Seattle, San Francisco, definitely San Francisco.
Yep.
Monterey Bay.
Monterey Bay.
Yeah.
It ends up in these things, and they go, it gets on these boats. And so, like, when you're traveling on a work boat from Seattle, if you want to use the inside passage, you have to call Canada and say, hey, I'm going to use the inside passage. And they say, okay, well, don't make landfall.
You don't have a passport or whatever.
And
is that through the Puget Sound?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. They don't stop you.
Mm.
You don't have to go through customs on a work boat.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
they're not searching it.
They're not searching you. And I mean, unless they have some type of reason.
Yeah.
And unless you're like an idiot, you're not giving them reasonable suspicion.
Sure.
So that's especially when you get way out the chain, it's either coming in on a plane or a boat.
Because Alaska just strikes me as a lot of really sketchy fucking people
there
go
is.
To Alaska to purposefully escape.
If you're in Alaska, you were born there. Or you're running from something.
Okay. That's fucking crazy.
I just got married. What does that mean about?
Maybe you were running from something.
No, I just wanted to make some money and try to be tough.
Yeah.
But sure. Okay. So you and a lot of other guys, I guess I was imagining like some kind of thing where you're getting drugs from the Russians and like,
Yeah. So personally, like when I had my little, you know, dabblance in it was, I had a connection in Seattle and I would buy it and then I would,
But that's also because you needed to stay awake, right?
Yeah, for me personally, but there was a lot of money in it too.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, selling it.
So you basically captained a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And you were, first mate. Essentially.
So I was the captain, and I was my dad's first mate, I guess. When he was on the boat, I would step down and be, you know. Well, I was the skiff guy, first mate, engineer. I did it all.
And how many guys would you have under you?
3 to 4.
Okay. And this is crabbing on a smaller boat.
Crabbing, seining, salmon, doesn't matter. It was always 3 to 4 people.
But when did you do the king crabs?
So I just went and worked on a king crab boat for one of my, one of my dad's buddies over the winter before I was married. I was like, yeah, I want to go do king crab and say I did it. And it just wasn't that. It was actually easier than dungey fishing, I thought, because
Sure.
You don't have to hand stack the pots. Dungey fishing, you have to hand stack every single pot. And they're 120 pounds. And like our boat was 38 feet across and 56 feet long, or 58 feet long. And so when you have you pick this pot up off the table, walk it back there like this, stack it, and you have to stack them 6 foot high.
Jeez.
I was in the best shape of my life.
Well, but so the king crab one.
King crab, everything's lifted by a crane.
Crane.
Other than it being cold and miserable, and it's a mental game more than anything. Physically, I didn't think king crabbing was that tough. I mean, yeah, you gotta, the crane's, you gotta push it and slide it across the deck. But as far as like repetitive heavy manual labor, it was blocks of bait.
So when you're seeing some on Deadliest Catch, that's the kings, and the reason they're I think focusing on that is because it looks so dramatic, right?
Yeah,
but they try to amp that up too.
First Deadliest Catch first ever came on, me and I remember we were sitting in our house in Coeur d'Alene, me and my stepdad, and like, oh, we're gonna watch this Deadliest Catch thing. You know, it was interesting because I was still pretty young at that point. And we're watching it, and my stepdad goes, why in the fuck are they hauling pots in the ditch?
The ditch,
when you're hauling pots, when you lay your pots out, you lay them in a string, right? You always want to face into the weather to haul, because your pot is going to, you can face the boat wherever you want. If the pot's down here, you can face the boat whatever direction you want to haul.
Right, right, right.
So would you want, you know, I mean, physics come into play. You've got a boat that's this wide, and you're gonna lay sideways with the waves, or are you going to put that 110-foot boat facing into it so that your seawall is breaking all the spray off the guys and you're not sitting there rolling, the pot's not swinging across the deck, it's swinging lengthwise with the boat.
Right. Yeah.
So they call that hauling in the ditch when you're laying sideways to the wave.
Okay.
But it makes better TV.
Yeah.
For sure. Because, if I mean, everybody wants to see, oh, that pot almost got him, you know. But no, typically when the pot comes out of the water, it would swing this way and not endangering.
Yeah, over the...
Not endangering everybody standing on the deck, right?
So they actually really wanted to endanger these crabbers to do it.
Just for this. And they wouldn't do it all the time. But yeah, they'd want some shots. And like, hey, let's haul some in the ditch and let's make this look sketchy, you know.
Wow.
The other thing that they did, and like I was saying, Bryce off the Amatuli that was running, he said when they'd film the boats coming into harbor, like after a spray icing, you know, when you're coming in and it's spray icing, you're icing up, but you want to keep all that ice off because it's dangerous. It makes the boat real top heavy. So they wanted some really good shots of the boats coming into harbor all iced up, you know, and the crew all iced up. So they bring the boats in, they get their crab offloaded, or no, wait. Yeah, they were all stacked out. So they had all the decks, the crab pots on deck.
Right.
They brought the fire department down with their fire engines and hosed the, because freshwater freezes a hell of a lot easier than saltwater.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right.
So they're there and they just hose these boats down and basically cover them in ice and then have them go back out and then get them, you know, the cameraman be out on the jetty filming those iced up crabbers coming in.
And it's all
just for show.
That is crazy how they just manipulate it.
Yeah, it was a total manipulation.
And it works too. It's almost like watching one of those is like watching Hunt for Red October. They dramatize it,
yeah,
make it all.
And the music's all dramatic.
Right?
Yeah.
And I get
that's
it.
TV.
I mean, that's TV. It makes good TV. They have a very successful franchise.
Sure.
Right? So, I mean, you got to respect that.
Well, now it makes sense, though, when some of the fishermen, you know, they're like this kid. He's
get
just
that
like,
shirt off.
Yeah, get
you don't
that
wear
deadliest, fucking thing
they don't
off.
Deadliest catch shirt anywhere on a real fishing
boat. Yeah, and he's like, the only difference between those fuckers and us is that we work hard all the time.
Yeah, so that's interesting that you're basically saying real crabbers and fishermen, they don't fuck
no.
Deadliest catch. That is really...
Well, if you want to make money,
like
I mean,
that, I'm a cowboy or whatever song, you don't play that on any jukebox in Alaska.
Okay.
Unless you want to get in a fight.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, the actual fishermen do not respect those guys.
Well, I'm good. Right, because they kind of sold out.
Or sellouts. They're big-time sellouts. Yeah, it's like your buddy that was really good guitar player and then all of a sudden sold to the record industry. It's the same goddamn
yep.
thing.
Do those guys, you think, know it, realize?
Oh, they know it. They don't care.
Are there any of those guys that were kind of serious dudes that you would have any respect? Like
Sig, I still respect Sig Hansen.
His daughter, too, huh?
Yeah, the one cute, I mean, actually cute fisher, you know, woman. Because, yeah, she was, but she got around.
Why do you respect Sig?
Because he didn't, I mean, yeah, he sold out, but for enough money, anybody will. But then he still tried to go do his own stuff and make, he actually tried to, like, I don't know if you've watched any of that stuff where he's over in, like, Norway.
Oh, no,
like, he actually tried to pioneer a new crab fishery over in Norway.
No shit.
And it's similar to king crab, but it's a different species. And he was the only one selling it. We tried to actually pioneer a new market. His brother, I don't know, that family, that's a long line of fishing families.
And are they the main family in Deadliest Catch? Or
yeah, that's the, that, okay. Sig's the big guy.
Well, there was Phil.
He's the man to beat. Captain Phil was,
and he died.
Right. Mm.
And when you say, okay, so, I'm sorry, when you say they died, is that pretty common for people to die in this job, in this line?
Oh, he died of he died because he was overweight and smoked cigarettes 24 hours all day.
He almost had a cigarette.
But yeah, there's a lot of that, especially when you get
a lot of accidents and stuff.
So accidents are incredibly common.
Okay.
But since the whole reason they got away with the Derby days was to lower that. I mean, because crab fishing was the highest mortality rate per capita of any other industry.
Mm-hmm.
during the Derby days.
And that was 80s. It was the 80s.
I'm pretty sure it was in the 80s. I was not, I had not become a fisherman at that point, so I couldn't really speak much on it. But the tales, you know, the old war stories that you hear.
Yeah.
The Derby days was, you had a whole bunch of people, you had X amount of crab to catch, and whoever brought them in got them.
Mm.
And it didn't matter weather, it didn't matter anything. So there was
no regulation.
There was some serious safety concerns because they're out there. That's the 7 days up, just crazy all out fishing.
Right.
Because when the quota's caught, everybody pulls their pots out of the water. You're done.
Mm.
And then they went to the quota system based on those landings. So. Okay. After when the Derby day, when they finally said, hey, maybe we shouldn't do this anymore, guys, you know, they regulated it. That's what got that. So the boats with the highest landings got the most, or, you know, the highest landing history got the most quota. It's the same thing they did off the coast when we bought our permit and they went to a pot limit. If your permit was associated in Oregon with, you know, this amount of landings, then you got 300 pots or 500 pots or 75 pots or whatever. That's how they would assign how many pots you got.
Okay.
Same thing with king crabbing. They would assign your quota based on your historical landings. So they wanted to basically, and I'm sure there was some good old boy stuff there where they were like, you know, the people that were making these regulations probably got some palms grease.
But yeah, sure.
The guys that had money, the guys that went out and worked, obviously should get more quota.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Once they went to a quota system, that's when you've got now the fishing of new, where it's like, well, it's kind of nasty out, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I'm not going to go out there in a hurricane to catch.
Which is obviously safer.
It is safer, but it doesn't make for as good a TB.
Well, you were telling me, like, being tired, that's where you get the most accidents, right? So yeah. It would make
tired sense. Makes more accidents than anything. And it is not just... I mean, you would know a little bit about it, but it's not just tired. It is, I mean, it's tired past what most people can even understand.
Right.
Because it's physically,
oh my God.
Mentally, it's a different kind of tired.
Yeah.
I mean, I can be tired after a day of work. You don't know tired until you spend a week on a fishing.
Hey there, listeners. Are you tired of driving around in a car that doesn't shine? Let me introduce you to Idaho Express Detail. Established in 2018, this local gem in Boise has been transforming vehicles and leaving them sparkling clean ever since. With a stellar 5-star rating, you know you're getting top-notch service every time. Whether you're in need of a quick wash or a full detailing service, their expert team has got you covered. Located at 515 South Vista Avenue, they're just a hop away from giving your ride the makeover it deserves. And don't forget to follow Idaho Express Detail on Instagram for amazing before and after shots and special promotions. So why wait? Treat your car to the best. Swing by Idaho Express Detail today and see the difference for yourself. Do you struggle with sleep, stress, or mental fatigue? Discover the power of Sarasate, a revolutionary, non-invasive neurotechnology that helps your brain rebalance and reset itself naturally. At Sarasate, they use advanced brain technology to support your brain's own ability to relax, reset, and restore. Their safe, proven approach has helped thousands improve their sleep, reduce stress, and enhance overall well-being. Imagine waking up refreshed with a clear mind and renewed energy. That's the difference Sarasate can make. Whether you're dealing with insomnia, PTSD, or just everyday stress, their personalized sessions can help you find the peace and balance you deserve. Visit Sarasate.com, that's Sarasate.com, today to learn more and schedule your free consultation. You can also reach them at 208-779-1040. Discover the natural way to a healthier, more balanced you. Attention book lovers, if you're looking for more empowering literature, welcome to The Lit Room, a beloved feminist bookstore in Garden City, Idaho. They specialize in women's literature, indie and small press gems, and a fantastic selection of works from local authors. The wonderful owners Chelsea and Megan are passionate about fostering a welcoming space for all readers. But that's not all. The Lit Room is expanding with a brand new book bar. Imagine sipping on a delicious beer, surrounded by shelves of captivating reads, all while unwinding in a cozy atmosphere. Visit them at 215 East 34th Street, Garden City, Idaho, and discover your next favorite book. Don't forget to follow them on Instagram at This Room Is Lit for updates, events, and more. Support local, celebrate women, and find your next read at The Lit Room.
Sounds insane.
You're so ungodly tired that I'm not, it affects your coordination,
right?
Your thought processes. But I wish they could bottle that sleep that you get. Like, so when I, you know, when come off a shift like that, you, the kind where you lay down and then you wake up 4 hours later and you haven't moved.
It was like, oh.
And it's like a complete blackout that just like real deep.
Pure exhaustion.
Well, and to get, I was so tired that I felt like I wasn't even asleep.
Yep.
And I would be like, I'd wake up, or I felt like I was still awake.
Like,
and I was
hallucinating.
Right. And the guy down below me in the bunk was like,
stress.
Well, yeah, but no, I was asleep, but I thought I was awake. And the guy below me said, oh no, you were assed out, man.
Wow.
And then like, so after like Bristol Bay, especially, because Bristol Bay, you go really hard up until the end and then you go home, right? You put the boat up, fly home. I've had several instances where we'd put the boat back up on the beach and I would wake up in a sheer panic because I didn't hear water against the hull, thought I'd run aground, run out on the deck in my underwear, and I'm like, oh, I'm in a hot boatyard, and go back, you know. And it takes you a minute because you're just like, I mean, it's just, even though like Bristol Bay per se isn't that long of a season, you would still just get so exhausted to the point where it was just, I mean, it was crazy.
Oh, man, it doesn't sound like it needs to be that long.
No, you would, insane. That would definitely be, that would be the new deadliest catch. If that season was 3 months long, it would be deadliest.
when I got home fishing, whatever the hell I was doing it in my sleep. I'd wake up against the wall and my knuckles were bruised because I was, you know, sorting shit.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm hitting the wall.
Oh, my God.
And I woke up, my mom would come in, and because that's where I came home to before I went back to Boise. And she'd come in and be like, what are you doing? I'm like, what? And I'm like sitting there like, just the wall is marked up.
That is fucking wild.
I remember going and trying to throw the anchor off of our fucking porch.
Here in Idaho?
No, in Idaho, but it was in Coeur d'Alene. Like, this was when I was like still in high school, but I remember running outside because we had a lake house in Coeur d'Alene. I remember running outside to throw the anchor until I'm like, as a pine tree,
weird. Damn it. A human brain works like that. Like, you guys get into that routine of doing that so much that it literally becomes either in your dreams or even when you're not doing it at all, still are in that, like, the fight or flight mode.
Oh, yeah.
You were being in that.
I wasn't cool, though. I wasn't the cool guy up top. I was the fucking doofus in the fucking...
You were in the factory?
Yeah, well, no. I was on a boat.
Yeah.
But they, for some reason,
they've got the factory, so on a catcher processor such as that,
you've
got a deck, and
right,
you've got a factory. Your deck is your guys that run the trawl.
They're cool.
And then those are the fishermen, and you're the, you know... The slave ship down below there.
Yeah, right.
Or the barrel.
The bottoms.
They would have me swing through the hatch into like where they dump the fish, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm finding like, you find some monstrosity, you're like shifting fish around.
Mm.
And all of a sudden you see a monkfish for the first time. I'm like, whoa, what the fuck is that?
It was Irish lords. Did you ever see those?
No.
Or maybe I did. I don't know. Probably did. They're like a bullhead kind of, but so you watch like, the original Jurassic Park, the Velociraptor were flying.
Oh, that's the Diplodocus. No, it has the thing going out.
Yeah, that. So that's what Irish lords look like.
Oh, really?
Fuck? But they've got these giant cartilage lips that are like, are like 100.
Oh, I have seen those. Yeah.
Big spines that come out.
Oh, yeah, those are nasty.
Things are crazy.
One time, I was really startled. There was, I think, thank God it was half broken, but half of a king crab. It was a gigantic motherfucker, and it was half broken, so I uncover this big pile of fish, and this thing is just gunning for me, man, and it's like going, you know, and I'm like, man.
That's
what's this
freaky
thing? But dude, one thing I didn't, monkfish is delicious. Like, they would cook some of that up. One thing that they did that was just the best is, I guess we had the great cook, but we had bar none, some of the best food I've ever had. Man, he had steak. He had pot roast. He had fresh caught fish, obviously.
That's the only thing that makes some of those prison boats worth it is the food.
Oh, dude. Like,
as you look forward to it, you're like, it's the one luxury.
Especially with the exhaustion.
Yeah.
Just like, holy fuck, get deal with that.
I've never felt horny for food. And that was the only time I was like, I would fuck this food. It's so good. It's so good looking.
Yeah.
Just like rolling it and fucking like steak.
Dude,
fish.
I was looking at it. So my stepdad was like notoriously one of the cheapest people in the fucking bay for, as far as groceries came. And I don't eat fish. I've never liked fish. I will occasionally eat like a good smoked red if it's, if it was like filleted and high quality filleted, frozen, no bloodshot in it. Vacuum packed. I'll eat one of those.
Smoked.
That's it.
Salmon?
That's the only way I'll eat salmon is if it's...
It's too briny for me, man.
You hate seafood that much.
Like, what about crab, man? Like a crab cake?
Dude, I couldn't even be on the boat when they were cooking that shit.
Dude, my mom will just fucking take cold and crab.
I can't clam chowder. Everybody's like, oh, clam chowder. No.
And that's wild to be like, get into that lifestyle. And
dude, if it smells like... And here's the thing, like, so most people don't understand that if a fish smells like fish, it's already bad.
It smells all fishy?
Salmon,
if it's raw, but...
salmon, if it is raw, you know, I mean, like, it's laying on the deck, you cut its heart out while it was still beaten kind of thing, does not smell like fish. When it dies in a refrigerated seawater, like we were doing, and bled, it doesn't get bloodshotting, it dies in that...
So it's not a pink.
No, it's bright red. It's not pink.
Oh.
Reds are like, their meat is like a bright red orange, like the natural ones.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't smell like fish at all. Same thing with crab. Crab shouldn't smell like crab until it's dead, right? I mean, but most people if smell fish.
I guess I can feel you as far as what you experienced, but like what I did for a month and a half, you did all the time.
Yeah.
That's hard. That's hard shit, man.
I want to say 26 years.
My body hurt.
What?
Like, my whole soul fucking hurt after that.
But
after just how many weeks you said you did it?
6 weeks.
Wow.
So, crabbing, I mean, it's especially, like, when you start doing all these different seasons. So, you go to Bristol Bay for 6 or 8 weeks, and then you go down and seine for another 6 or 8, or you could seine for the whole 3 months in the summer. And then crabbing in the winter was basically 3 months. So,
you guys,
realistically, you're only looking at, you know, half the year that you're working. So,
I felt like it was I feel like cowboys, there's these myths that develop about them in the Old West. I feel kind of like there's industries, loggers, you know, obviously that's really hard work.
Yeah.
Fishermen, crabbers up there in Alaska. You know, there's a mystique that develops around it, you know?
Well, if you look at it, so like there, and this is what another thing that my stepdad told me, it's like, so if you look at towns like, have you ever been to like Kamei, Idaho, or Orofino, Husky?
In my name, right? Yeah.
Logging was their premier industry.
Right.
And back in the 80s, 70s, 80s, you know, somebody with either basic education could go out and make $200 a day. And in the 80s, that's like, what, 600 now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got these people, and again, I say this with all due respect.
Sure.
Those people are not bright.
Right.
They're not. We're not talking about Silicon Valley people here. We are talking about Kamei and Kuski or Orofino. They're not really that bright. Hardworking, nice people, give you the shirt off their back. I've spent a lot of time up here because that's where my stepdad's family was from.
I respect people like that a lot more.
I respect the shit out of
bags in Silicon Valley.
Oh, exactly. But what the problem was is when the environmentalists came in and shut down the logging. I mean, Kamei at one point had like 3 mills. Okay, they shut down the logging industry. So now you've got all these people that aren't really smart enough to do anything else but work hard.
You take away the only industry where hard work actually pays, and what do you end up with? A ghost town and a meth addiction.
Right. And so that's what's going on all over. I think whatever industry it might be, when you work hard and you're like, I want to work hard, I want to get paid fairly for hard work, whether you're in Detroit, Michigan, or you're farm country, or you're up there with the loggers or up there with the crabbers, you want to work your ass off, I will happily do that so I can, you know, help my family or what, go catch one on in Seattle, whatever.
Exactly.
But I'm willing to work hard. And then they yank that industry out. And I, by they, I mean, you know, we got a combination of takers there, exploiters. We got the industries themselves. We got those tied to onto it through politics, right? And you see, like, there's this anger that they kind of know where to send it, but they're not totally sure, right?
Mm.
I think that's what we're seeing a lot in America today. I think we're seeing, you know, it's not fair that I work this hard and I can't get a chunk of that American dream.
You can't anymore. I mean, the only people that get a chunk of the American dream are the people that are, well, it's like you're not selling tangible products anymore.
Right.
It's like there was two ways to make money in the gold rush, right?
Yeah.
Strike rich or sell them shovels.
Right. Or you work for the guy who struck it rich.
That's bro money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But they still got treated fairly.
Yeah.
Like that, there was an Irishman named Timothy Regan up in Silver City. He made a shit ton of money, and he paid his miners, fellow Irishmen, $8 a day in the 1860s, and that was like huge money.
Oh, yeah.
So that gave them shots at other things. Like, you know, like this Trident fisherman, right?
Mm-hmm.
These monopolies or smiley fish or whatever you call the fucking... Bay Beauty or Sea Beauty or
whatever. Ocean Beauty.
Ocean Beauty. Yeah. You know, it's like, why can't people like that not fuck over fishermen?
You know, they will actually tell you that they're not making that much money either. It's, they're lying.
You're right.
They're lying.
Yeah.
But so there was a guy, John Lawrence, he started Leader Creek Fisheries, and he was like one of the first ones to pioneer the frozen, vacuum-packed, top-quality fish.
Right, right.
What up? And he made it a co-op to where you actually owned a portion of the bank. And that's where he actually stood out from the rest. Is like, now, instead of just selling Trident your fish, you actually own a piece of the market now. So when he sold his fish at Pike's Place, we got a kickback from that, too.
Well, yeah... And
he was really good, and that's why he got this huge following, and then all these other co-ops started to spring up, and so it was actually a really good thing.
Dude, if I was an owner, something like that, you know what I'd love to do? I'd love to give my fishermen some really, you know, great, like, give them a solid income, you know? And I'd like to go drink with the fucking guys at the bar so you can walk in there and not act like an ass bag that monopolizes everything. I don't understand this whole need... I guess I haven't been there. Obviously, I'm not a trillionaire or millionaire. I thought we're getting to a trillionaire. But it's just kind of like, we know that, capitalism works if people at the top, you do let it trickle down. But so few do.
So, like, I mean, perfect example is this new company I just went and started work for, right? I'm really actually quite impressed.
Right. You were telling me about.
I mean, and granted, it could be a honeymoon phase. But so far... I feel that that they actually do see and value their employees. I mean, down to like wishing me a happy birthday. Yes.
When you were saying like when you leave, sometimes what was it? They have watermelon and
oh yeah. So like before, everybody gets holiday pay, right?
Right.
So Monday I worked Labor Day because I'm not camping or anything, so why not? Right.
Right.
So it's double pay for because I hadn't been there 30 days. If I had been there 30 days and had was eligible for my paid vacation, I would have got triple time all day Monday. I can work as much overtime as I want, but I mean it's not mandatory obviously, but I can work 50, 60 hours a week if I want to. They of course compensate me for that fairly. But on a holiday weekend, so Thursday before Labor Day weekend, right?
Yeah.
They send you home with a watermelon and a six-pack of not cheap burgers, like actual hand
squish, like good burners, and a 2 pound thing of bacon for your barbecue that weekend. They do turkeys on Thanksgiving. They do hams for Christmas. But so,
they pay you well.
And they've got, you know, enough leadership in place that you're not just like another number. I don't know how it is on the assembly side or anything, but like as far as the department I work in, they treat their employees great.
All of the history that I've read about industry, you got mining, you got farming, you got fishing, whatever it is. When you have a dissatisfied working base, it's always, you know, I think Trump, Harris, whatever.
Mm.
The main problem is not we blame everybody else, but what the problem is that you got these exploitive motherfuckers. When you have a solid income and comfort at home and security and you can go do some fun shit,
mm-hmm.
you don't have it. People are much more accepting of differences mm-hmm. and things like that. And it's just like, I think Trump and Harris, whatever you want to say, are kind of beside the point almost. You know,
agreed. We've lost sight of a lot of things there.
It's just, yeah, capitalism can work, but I don't know what to do to make somebody do the right thing.
So not only can capitalism work, but I think capitalism is healthy to a certain extent.
Me too.
Because, so like fishing, right?
There's no perfect system, but that's the only thing.
Fishing, as a deckhand, as a full share, they call it, deckhand.
Right.
I got paid by the pound. I did better if the boat did better. Obviously, I did that the most of my life. So, I mean, that's where I made most of my money. But I went and dabbled in a solar installation for a while.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I have friends that are doing that.
Dude, I loved it.
Yeah.
You know why I loved it? Because it was performance-based.
I'm by
the... I did not get paid hourly. I got paid by the panel. The more panels I put up, the more money I made.
So it's incentivized.
I was done every day by noon, and I was making, you know, $1,500 a week.
Fuck yeah.
I'm buying shitty-ass faucets.
That's my buddy Logan right now.
Since everybody likes solar, I'm just going out, and I'm fucking
using
underballed for just fucking the dirtiest fossil fuels I can find. It was like that Beavis and Butthead where they think they hit, like, black gold.
And then like, sewage.
You want, and they're going door-to-door selling oil, and... in barrels, and it's shit. They hit a septic tank.
Oh my god.
What are you doing, John? But anyway, I mean, I don't know. I think the fights we have going on over, you know, social issues and those things, I guess they matter, but yeah, they do matter. But I think those things are always, those divides we feel are always amplified
mm-hmm.
when we don't have shit. Great Depression, and then you get World War II, right?
Yeah. People don't want to work hard. It's like, I would talk, I mean, there's groups of people where I could say, oh, dude, peace work is the way to go. And they're like, oh, no, but then what about the guy that can't do as much work? It's like, well, he doesn't make as much money.
Right.
You know, why should it be fair? It's equal opportunity, not equal results.
Right. It's like sports, man. Sports in like crabbing or fishing. I noticed this, like, okay, you're the bottom guy, right? You're a greenhorn.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you make a little money like I did and I go, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy. I've experienced it. Or if you work really hard, then you perhaps have the shot to go up to the next level and get a little bit more income and fish. But you got to work hard to do it.
Yeah, you start out as a half share. You work your way up to a full share deckhand.
But I do think there's a lot of people out there that don't mind working hard if they can live off that.
Mm. Well, and that's the other thing is that full share needs to actually be worth, it needs to translate into actual value. I mean, yeah, just because I'm the manager doesn't mean I didn't make, you know, or whatever.
Well, it probably helps too if your crabbers aren't snorting cocaine, you know.
Like I said, that was part of the P&L.
Right.
You know, I gotta buy that cocaine, man. You know, I was like, well, we have this much cocaine, make it last.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I guess it makes a lot of sense. You got a crazy ass environment up in Alaska.
Yeah.
You got long hours.
Yeah.
Rich history.
Rich history. You got lots of cables. And yeah, yeah. So that's one thing I wanted to know, and I didn't ask at first, but what do we know about the history of fishing and crabbing up in Alaska? How long has it been going on for?
So I would, what the heck? So I think it's called, I think the book is called Burning the Iceberg.
Oh, cool.
And I read it like forever ago, and it's written by a Bristol Bay fisherman at the turn of the at the turn of sailboats to diesel.
Wow.
Shore. Fascinating book. It's a fisherman wrote it, so we're not talking about like super novel here. It's a pamphlet.
No, but that's a source. We call that a primary source.
Yeah.
This is what this is. This is primary source
because he talks about and it's written from the point of view of an old blue collar hardworking fisherman that had just switched to, he's talking about,
it's a rod dogging it, baby.
He's talking about the first wooden shore boat to hit Bristol Bay after they just switched. I mean, there's still sailboats present. They hadn't like limited the entry yet, and it's mostly primarily natives. It's a fascinating.
And they would fish before with
sailboats, man. They'd fish with sailboats, gill net, and they're like hauling gill nets over the side in a freaking sailboat.
What about crabbing?
Crabbing, I don't really know a whole lot of the history on crabbing. I know that I know more about the coastal stuff, like the Lapush native stuff. They say they used to crab. And that's another thing that's a whole nother rant you could go down with the whole native fishery on the coast. Because they get to fish 45 days before anybody else.
You were telling me that. And so a lot of
weather days.
A lot of guys, you were saying, marry native women
work ethic into the native-only fishery.
I mean, like, we're talking millions
of dollars.
So oil versus fish, but you're talking about, like, wow.
That's super interesting.
My stepsister, my dad married this lady in Port Angeles, Washington. She already had two kids, and their dad was in the, he was full, whatever Indian that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has some crab rights in the Port Angeles area, but they're not the good crab rights. Like, if you want the good crab rights, you got to get out to like Lapush and the real coastal towns. But they get to fish 45 days before anybody else.
I mean, we're talking millions.
The Judge Bolt decision. And if you have ever crabbed, most of your season is made in the first week. That first drop of pots, that's when most... So like 75% of your season is made in the first 10 days.
Wow.
So these natives that would go out there in these like wooden rowboats or dinghies or whatever the hell they were using, but they would go out, they'd have the, according to, Washington has gone quite liberal, more power to them, whatever. The natives got to go out 45 weather days ahead of the white fishermen.
Wow.
And those guys won't go out if there's more than a sneeze of wind. So they just basically, they'll just go out and drop their pods. Well, then you got a couple of this guy, he actually used to run block for one of the guys that we fished with in San Francisco. And he goes up to Lapush and finds him some big old native girl at the end of the bar and says, "Hey, all you got to do is be on the boat." And I will make you money.
Wow.
And I mean, he was putting his gear away by the time all the rest of the white guys were going out to go fishing. He's like, "I made $7 million. I'm done for the year. I'm fucking done."
That is fucking crazy.
Because he'd go out, basically, if you go out there with that hard work ethic, like, because we go out, they call them carpet bombing, right? Because we'd go out and we'd drop 900 pots and catch every crab.
Uh-huh.
And so he'd go out and he had a 500 pot permit or whatever the case was. 45 days ahead of everybody else, and he'd just mop up the entire shelf of Dungeness crab, and then he'd go stack his gear out at the end of the 45 days.
Would the crab come back?
Oh, there's still a crab, but there's just not... I mean, like I said, if you don't catch it in that... Right. So he's basically mopped up an entire season's worth of crab for everybody he just caught.
Right.
And so...
Jeez.
It just made it...
So they're intentionally trying to marry into American families
so
that they can have... fishing rights.
Yeah, it's like winning the lottery.
The average white guy.
Yeah. Because the native just has to be, I think it has to be a native owned boat. So I think he signed his boat over to her and shit.
And I mean, that might be fair to the natives who have been fucked over.
No, I think it's great for them.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think it's great for them.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's not their fault they were on our land before we got here.
Uh-huh.
But,
well, you're married to a native woman, right?
I'm not married, but yes, I am with a Alaska native. She's part Alaska native, so my kids are part Alaska native. And it's from the, up in Alaska, it's Inupik.
Inupik.
Okay. Unalakleet Indians.
Unalakleet.
And they're not Indians, they're Alaska natives. Yeah, so the Unalakleet natives are, and they're not a good native tribe to even be, because other than the fact that they get like state health care and they can go to any state university, there's really no benefits. Because they're not sitting on the North Slope with all the oil.
Well, my goodness. Yeah, see, this is exactly what I wanted. I wanted a kind of a true dive into this is what a lot of people don't know.
I think this is awesome.
I love this.
This is exactly what we want to do is just take here's some raw shit. Let's talk about it.
And this is history, regardless of, you know what I mean? It really is.
Well,
like,
people think history, it has to be like, me as a historian projecting something.
Right. You're right. But right now is history. Right.
This is what we call in the history field a primary source. You know, you're talking about things that you experienced and that are going on when you experienced them for other people.
Yeah.
Therefore, this is a primary source.
Like the book you talked about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, dude. Honestly, I'm not a big reader. And I remember reading it. I was
Remind me what it was called.
Burning the Iceberg.
Burning the Iceberg. That's a great name.
It was. Especially
for now.
It was a great name.
Yeah. Titanic would have loved it.
It was like a true fear. And I think it's actually like classified as fiction because it's a fisherman who doesn't fucking tell fish tales.
Okay. Right?
But if you know, from somebody who's actually been in Bristol Bay, 99%, he might have embellished a couple of things, but 99% of that book is 100% true.
The best book I've ever read was about the Vietnam War, and it's called The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien.
I read that.
Do you know what I'm talking
about? What a crazy book.
That is, I think, the best book I've ever read.
Oh, it's an insane book. And it's really insanely good is what I mean.
And I would say, like you're saying, it's kind of, it's fiction. Like a lot of that book is fiction. And
but it's not.
But it's not. It's like, it's still written from the perspective of a real Vietnam vet. And what, even in the things that.
Well, he was a Vietnam vet. Tim,
exactly. Well, but in order to go nonfiction, every source has to be vetted. And who wants to go through that for
us? Yeah. And it's like, even the fiction might be how it felt or what. There's sometimes more truth in the tales than is in the real document.
Well, you got a true book. You got a nonfiction book called Son of the Morning Star about Custer.
Oh, I've read that. About Custer. Right. So funny story. My family is
a lot of bullshit in
Custer.
Thought, okay.
Wow. Yeah. So my mom's sister married Greg Custer, who's, you know, great great grandpa was, but
to funniest
lady. Yeah, a distant relative. But so his grandmother Dorothy taught me how to sew and stuff in high school. She was like this 4'11", just wiry old. Everybody loved her. Just, she was one of the greatest human beings I've ever met in my life. She had like a seamstress business since like 1912 or something. She was 100 and something when she died.
Oh my gosh.
She went bungee jumping off the Prime Bridge, or not bungee, she went base jumping off the Prime Bridge when she was 100. Did the zip line. She was on Leno twice.
No shit.
Yeah, dude, so funny. So if you got to watch the Leno thing, Dorothy Custer Leno, but she's talking, she goes to California for the first time. She's like 100 and something. It's Valentine's Day. She goes on Leno. And because I don't know how the connection, one of the producers for Leno was lived in Twin Falls or something, knew her story, so wanted to get her out. So she goes to Disneyland and she gets the, you know, VIP old person tour of Disneyland, and she loved her like big purple hats. And so she's on Leno talking about this. She goes, "Yeah, it was windy yesterday, and the guy was taking us around Disneyland, and I was holding on to my hat, and my dress blew up, and." And the guy goes, "Ma'am, you might want to let go of that hat." And she goes, "Why? This is a brand new hat." What's down there is 100 years old. If they want to look, that's their problem. But yeah, it's like the fun. She was just the cutest little old lady, dude, and everybody loved her. Nobody had a bad thing to say about her. 100 years old, she's down there playing with the great, great, great grandkids, you know, wow. Crawling around.
Jay Leno, you said?
She was on Leno. Wow. It was, she was on Leno twice. She was like Valentine's Day, and then he had her come back for another time.
That's awesome.
She was, you know.
I had a great aunt. She was 105. Inga. She is very Norwegian.
Dorothy. It's like Dorothy, Inga. Yeah, the old names last out.
Yeah.
But people would be like, you know, I'd be like, and, you know, on the tour, I have a picture of a victim of a crime that looks a lot like her.
Mm-hmm.
To be like, oh, this reminds me of Aunt Inga when she died. And people are like, well, when did she die? What happened? You know, how did she die? They're like, old age. I was like, no, I'm fucking.
It's a good way to go out, I think.
Like, I mean, if you're going
to go, why not go that
time to go?
Yeah, but this has been an informative conversation.
One question before we wrap.
Fuck off,
love. Before we wrap things up, okay. I have to ask one thing. My sister wanted me to ask this.
Okay.
And I kind of already feel like I know the answer, but she wanted me to ask about if you had any weird supernatural stories, or like people talk about sirens, or, you know, mermaids,
so
weird
like
shit.
St.
Like
Elmo's fire. You remember the St.
I've heard of it.
Fire.
Yeah.
And so basically, it's like the old wooden ships used to spontaneously combust. So
spontaneous combustion.
It's not really spontaneous, though. So there's a science behind it.
Okay.
What is the coolest thing? So we're coming. Yeah, I only actually ever experienced it once, and it wasn't the actual full fire event, obviously. But we're coming back, and when you pass a metal object ungrounded through a humid environment,
okay,
it builds up a static char.
Mm.
What most people don't realize is that electricity produces light regardless of whether or not it goes through a thing. It's not much of a light, but it's a light. It was a flat, calm, just like eerily calm night. The northern lights are going. And I walk out on the back deck, and you've got, so anytime you chop up the water, sometimes they've got that bioluminescent algae. Mm-hmm. So the froth behind the boat is like this just really low green. I've tried to take several pictures of it, but it doesn't produce enough light to actually show up on a camera, right? But I turned around to walk back into the house, and all the masts are glowing.
Wow. Oh, jeez.
Because of all the static that's built up on. And it was the coolest, like, I'll never experience it.
And that's St. Elmo's fire?
Well, so because I looked into it, I'm like, why? And I was like, because I was thinking, oh, did I just see some shit?
Yeah.
What's going on? But, but yeah, I was like, well, I'm not that tired. But yeah, they used to call it St. Elmo's fire, and it was because, you know, mass on the old wooden ships would develop this charge. If they were properly grounded, they could actually develop enough charge to lightning strike over to something that was grounded, and then it would fire or catch fire, you know, especially if you had a wooden boat and a paper mast, you know, all this shit. It was fairly combustible, right?
It's crazy.
That was one of the coolest things I've ever seen in my life.
And they didn't probably for a long time have a scientific
explanation for that. That's thing. Why they called it St. Elmo's fire. I'm like, oh. This whole fuss on it. But it's
just,
the actual like static electricity, and it built like this aura around the entire upright everything on the boat. It was crazy.
Holy shit. And you only got to see that one time?
One time.
In
my 20 something years of fishing, I saw it one time.
That is fucking awesome.
Didn't you get an argument with your sister about this? Like science behind.
I am of the belief that maybe not all, but most magic can be explained by science, or will eventually be explained.
Well, yeah, just like those motherfuckers in the Dark Age.
Yeah,
they're like, you know, that's
imagine showing up with a cell phone.
Yeah,
that's what I was saying to her. I was saying, you know, a guy like Nikola Tesla, apparently she said he actually was into mysticism and spirituality.
Yeah, I loved him.
Yeah, he's such an interesting guy. But I mean, if you look at someone who's trying to harness electricity 300-400 years ago, they would be like, you're magic, you have superpowers, you're a god, you know, you're Zeus or whatever.
If I had a time machine, I'd fly fucking back there, dude. I'd be shagging chicks, man.
Oh, dude, I'd be a straight pimp. Yeah. I would own shit.
I'd just go with a magic aid ball. To be like,
you're a psychic
and a lighter. What was that movie, Army of the Dead or Dawn of the Dead?
Was it on Netflix?
No, it was an old movie.
Dawn of the Dead is the
Skeleton Army.
Oh, you're thinking of...
It's
you,
a...
Maybe that's Army of the... You're talking about
Army
Evil
of
Dead. Dead. Evil Dead sequel is Army of the Dead?
The prequel, the one way back one.
But it's
where
the same...
That old guy's like, I brought my boomstick.
Yes.
And a fucking lighter.
That's an evil, the Evil Dead universe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that shit. Well, this has been a fun conversation.
No, this has been awesome.
I'll come back anytime.
Yeah. We would love to have you back.
I would love to come back.
We'll talk about logging.
This has been a great...
logging.
This has been a great...
Get into logging.
Oh, dude.
I didn't really get to go into that. Yeah, yeah.
Helicopter logging.
I think people are realizing with podcasts, you know, we have great conversations. We might as well just record them. You know, maybe we can get some people to listen.
So true. Yeah. So true.
All right. Well, this has been Highway to History. And we'll leave some information about where you can reach Phillips about his mechanic services.
For sure.
They're great. He won't screw you over. Trust me.
Thanks, guys. We'll be right back.